Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this first segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Carrie Shabarami, board member for the Chromosome 9P- Network. Tell me a little bit about the Chromosome 9P Network.
The Chromosome 9P- Network We're in our 30th year of activity. It started in 1984 from the parent. It was a 9P- parent, John Storr, and he began searching for other 9P- families through genetics hospitals. And slowly through the years, we have gained members and reached out to other parts of the world. And now we have approximately 430 families worldwide. And all members have a 9P- child in their care. It's either parents or guardians. And each family is represented, you know, represents a 9P- individual.
So how does being a 9P- individual affect a person?
It's similar. I always kind of, make the similarity to Down syndrome. It's a condition that there is no cure for. Once you have a 9P deletion, you obviously have it for life. And it's also similar in a way to autism in that it's kind of a spectrum. We have children who, on paper, have the exact same karyotype, is how it's identified, but they can present with very varying symptoms. They can be profoundly affected, like in a wheelchair, nonverbal, or they can have more subtle symptoms and maybe even be able to take community classes with, you know, a great deal of support. On average, most of our kids require a great deal of assistance and care and are often dependent upon care after age 18. And there's a lot of medical issues that also accompany having 9P-.
So, can you tell me about the specific work of the network?
Like I said, we started in the 84 range. Basically, the biggest thing with 9P- is a lack of information, both in research and just, you know, published data. Doctors don't know about it, if they've even heard about it before. And it's pretty difficult to treat your child or to have an idea of what to expect with your child if you have no information to fall back on. So the biggest need from a parent standpoint would be getting information. So they began early on to exchange letters yearly, parent to parent, just kind of telling what their child has done, and it began as a yearbook program. And that's probably one of our most sacred parts of our network. To this day, we publish a yearbook for every family. And basically, the parents, it's voluntary, but they're able to write, you know, what their child's doing, include pictures, maybe if you've used products that you found that had helped, they can list those, what, you know, therapies they've tried, medications they've tried. And that really helps share information and support for each other. So the yearbooks are probably the most important part of our network itself. Also, every 3 years we have a family reunion somewhere in the United States. And this year, 2014, happens to be a family reunion year. In July, we're meeting in Vermont. We're hoping to have at least 40 families from mainly the U.S., but oftentimes before we've had families from like India and the U.K. and Canada also attend. And we basically spend the weekend meeting, sharing information, kind of in roundtable discussions. And we have a lot of kid-friendly and disability-friendly activities for the kids to keep them well-supervised and busy and happy while the parents are meeting. And probably the most important part of this meeting is oftentimes, especially for new families, is the first time they've ever laid eyes on another 9P- child besides their own. And you can probably imagine your child being diagnosed with this extremely rare genetic condition and never actually getting to see another child with it. So it's a magical experience. We went in 2011 and were able to attend, and it really, we left there feeling like our souls were full in a way that we were able to see other families and other children. And also our network does several other activities throughout the year. We publish 2 newsletters. We have a birthday card program where each child gets a birthday card on their birthday. We have an angel card program, which unfortunately is for the children who pass away throughout the year. And we have a private Facebook group, which facilitates exchanging of information for families, and as well as a couple other less prominent programs. All of this is funded through 2 fundraisers that we do yearly to help sustain our activities. And our network is a 501c3. We have no paid employees. All of our volunteers that run our organization are 9P- parents like myself who volunteer their time to keep the activities going. So it's very important for us. We have vested interest in keeping the network going to share information for our families and others.
So, in your time with the network, what sorts of challenges have been faced?
As a network, I'm on the board, but I'm also a parent. So, personally, challenges I face is actually managing my own child and trying to, you know, have the network grow as much as we'd like it to. So there's always a time issue with us not having any paid employees. But as the network itself, some of the challenges that we have faced is just the sheer lack of information that we have to go on for helping raise a child with 9P-. And not only for us as parents, but also for physicians that we see, they don't know that much about it. Even if they go research it, there's not a lot of information, and the information that's available is old. And some of it even dates back to Dr. Alfie, who is the physician who first discovered it, and that's one of the names of 9P- is Alfie syndrome. But also, teachers and therapists need a little guidance on how to treat the children. And with so little information, it's a struggle to make it available and make sure it's factual and up to date. Obviously, with a program such as a network such as ours, funding is always an issue. Like I said, we do have the 2 fundraisers yearly that help sustain our program, and we also have been able to get private donors in the past, often through memorials of children, to help fund our program.
So,
and as of lately, one of our biggest challenges has been a language barrier. We recently, just last week, I enrolled a family from Ukraine. It's a Russian-speaking mom with no telephone access. And it's been a struggle to find information to be able to give her that she can translate into and to help her with her child. So Google Translate has helped out quite a bit, but there's no one even close to her in the area that has a 19-minute child. And we're really reaching out to new parts of the world that we have never had before, but that also includes new languages and new time zones, and it's all a new struggle for us to try to meet the needs of those families and give them the data that they need to help raise their children. In addition to the Ukraine, we've also seen, just in the last year, remember, a new family from Ghana. We had a family from Turkey, Thailand, Luxembourg. I mean, and that's in addition to the other parts of the world that we already had members in. Most of our members are U.S.-based, but we have quite a few families in Canada, Australia, England, and other European nations like Switzerland, like Germany. So we're definitely spread across all areas.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Always a remarkable thing, folks, to hear about someone with a given condition meeting someone like them for the very first time. It can be a remarkable gift in providing knowledge that they're not facing their condition alone, and that there is help and hope out there. Sometimes, to extend oneself to a situation where you'd be first meeting someone with a similar condition, or even just getting to know different facets of the disabled community, can be a risky first step, or so it would seem. Once a person takes a chance to get to know others, they can find the support and the information can make a world of difference. Truth is, fear can hold anyone back, whether they have a disability or not. But it's a lot worse if you're facing a given condition with the perception that you're facing it alone, because it's never true. There's always support. There's always the possibility of making things better, at least in some way. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Come on, come on.
How much did your band make at your last show? What if I told you that you could make an additional $75 per gig? SOCAM members who perform registered original material may be eligible for payment. What is SOCAM, you ask? SOCAM is the Society of Composers, Authors, and Music Publishers of Canada, the Canadian copyright collective that administers the performing rights of more than 90,000 members. For details on how to get paid for your music and for free registration, adjust your web browser to socan.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Carrie Shabarami from the Chromosome 9P- Network. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Steph Craig and Mary Edwards. They'll be giving us an update on the work of the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada. So what can you tell me about the new initiatives for the Turner Syndrome Society?
Well, one of my main focuses right now is our upcoming conference in Montreal. It's May 23rd to 25th, and we've got a program that I'm very pleased with. We have, Dr. Sherry Deal talking about hormones. We have Dr. Luc Bouchin from Ottawa talking about heart health in Turner Syndrome, and we have Dr. Jean-François Lepage talking about brain structure and learning in the Turner Syndrome. And we have one of our favorite psychologists, Dr. Dean Mooney from Vermont, who is works a lot with girls with Turner Syndrome and is very experienced with nonverbal learning disabilities. So he's going to have a lot to contribute as well. Really excited about the program. It's great entertainment and good program for the girls. They're going off to the Montreal Biodome.
So,
their expedition, and they have a dance and movement workshop with some very good choreographers and dancers leading.
So, will this conference have anything unique over previous years?
I think it has updates. It does have a rather interesting panel of women with Turner syndrome who have become parents in various ways. One of them has become a mother through international adoption, one through in vitro fertilization, and the other is a very unusual case because she is conceived naturally. And that is very rare with women with Turner syndrome. So we'll have those three women giving their stories, and a fertility expert from the McGill Health Sciences Center to give an overview and an update on the in vitro fertilization techniques that are available.
So, for those who might have missed our prior interviews, can you tell me a little bit about the society itself, its work up to this point?
Well, we've been going for in operation for 34 years now. That formed in 1981, and it has grown from basically a local organization in Toronto to a national organization with 5 chapters and 4 other local support groups right across Canada. And we have a website, a Facebook page, a newsletter, and we try to provide an annual conference. This one in Montreal is our 33rd conference, and each one seems to get a little better in its program and attract a few more people. It's very gratifying to see that the programs of the society are working and providing support and providing information for women and girls with Turner syndrome.
One of the main goals of the society is fostering communication between women with Turner syndrome as well as parents and other family members of young girls with Turner syndrome. Though, as Mary mentioned, we have various chapters throughout Canada which hold events to connect members, as well as our annual conference. And we also try to connect members using various online initiatives such as our Facebook page. And we also conduct membership surveys to assess the programs and services that the society offers.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the methods used to inform and educate the public concerning this work?
In terms of the public education, I think our website is one of the major ones. Well, our newsletter is available on our website, and it's distributed mostly to our own supporters. And that includes some of the medical clinics. So some people who are otherwise interested would get the newsletter through the clinics. And another effort, or another major information resource we have is our information book called Turner Syndrome Across the Lifespan. And we're just about sold out of that. We're in the process of arranging a reprint of that book, because it's been so successful.
So, what sorts of challenges are typically faced by someone affected with Turner syndrome?
You want to start on that one, Stephanie?
Okay. I would say some of the challenges faced by individuals with Turner syndrome are a lot of the various medical challenges that can occur due to the syndrome, such as hearing loss, concerns with the heart and kidneys, as well as some difficulties with spatial perception. So there are various degrees of Turner syndrome in relation to what part of the X chromosome is missing, which can affect you medically in various ways. I would say another challenge also could be socially, which is why the society focuses so much on fostering communication between members. It can be very difficult to find someone in your area who has Turner syndrome as well, or medical professionals who have a solid knowledge of Turner syndrome and the effects associated with it. Though I know personally for me, I didn't know anyone with Turner syndrome until I was probably around 21 and went to my first conference. So it's been a very interesting experience when I went there and met other women with Turner syndrome and heard their stories. And now I've become even more integrated into this society, and it's just been a fantastic experience.
Mm-hmm. The consistent features of Turner syndrome are short stature and lack of ovarian development. And because the ovaries don't develop, the natural female hormones have to be replaced with artificial ones through a pill. And also, because the ovaries don't develop, there's no egg production in almost every case. And that means, of course, there's infertility. And so those two issues, being shorter than the average height and being infertile, are two major issues as well. The shortness is not, it's in the lower, there, it's just below the lower range of female height. The average height for an untreated Turner syndrome woman is 4'7" or 4'8". And these days, recently there's been available growth hormone treatment for girls who are still in the growing phase of their lives. And that makes a difference. And it can vary from a couple of centimeters to 4 or 5 inches. So depending on the response of the individual.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the successes of the society?
I think sheer survival is one of them. Every nonprofit has its ups and downs, and we have weathered a couple of those. But we're here. We have strong supporters from the family, among the families and the individuals with Turner syndrome, and that's carried us through. We have great volunteers on our board and in our chapters, so that's one of our strengths. And we also, I think, have. From that strength, we've gained the support we need to do things like the conference and things like our information book and the information pages that we put out and our website, the financial support and the volunteer support to build those projects has been really what's kept the society active. And over the past 9 years that I've been executive director, it's certainly been a growth story.
Yes, definitely. I think the conference is definitely a main success of the society as well. Just how we've been able to keep bringing all these medical professionals to the conferences to update everyone on the latest medical developments and social developments. And also just the number of really strong relationships that have been formed by people who have attended these conferences, and keep in contact after the conference is done, provide support to each other. It's mm-hmm. just been fantastic.
So if each of you could send one message about life with Turner syndrome and the work that goes on, what would it be?
I think I'd start, if I was talking to a woman with Turner syndrome, a young woman who was just sort of wondering, what does this mean for me? I'd say, yes, Turner syndrome makes a difference in your life. It doesn't define who you are. And all the health conditions do not affect everybody in the same way. Each woman with Turner syndrome has her own unique set of health concerns, but the overall list gives you a good checklist. It actually is an advantage when you go to the doctor. The doctor knows what they have to look for, what they have to have a baseline measurement about or do testing for, perhaps earlier than they might for any other woman.
Exactly. I think the message that I would give would be the importance of advocacy and self-advocacy, making sure that you let people know your needs and any concerns that you may have, and also that you're able to assert your independence as well. Because like Mary said, you know, Turner syndrome really doesn't stop us from achieving any of our goals. We may go about certain things a bit differently, but there's no reason why we can't achieve them. So I think if there's anything that you have as a goal that you would like to accomplish that you feel may not be as applicable because of your Turner syndrome, I'd say try it anyways and really just go for things that make you happy and things that you're interested in. Don't let any perceived limitations stop you from living your life.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you.
Of course. As Steph and Mary reminded me during the interview, one of the toughest things in all of disability life is the precept of facing it on your own. Bringing together people with a similar condition, even though the symptoms might not manifest themselves in exactly the same way, it can be a great source of support. It can be a matter of coming together and saying, this is someone who really understands it day to day. This is someone who can appreciate the things I'm feeling, the things I'm saying, and maybe who can suggest a better way of doing things. In disability life, as we all know, it can be a matter of steps, building up towards the best quality of life possible. Now, for Turner Syndrome Society, presenting a book, an information guide, which no doubt contains experience and proven information, can be just a great resource for people struggling with the condition. Because in disability life, it's also crucial to have the right information, not to just accept the first thing that's handed to you. I've found in many cases, if the answer's no, or this is impossible, or there's no hope, it's usually the wrong answer. Usually there is something, some way, that can be established just to make things better for individuals with disabilities. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the number 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. No matter what the condition, it's as important to have those connected to the situation supporting you as it is to inform and educate the public. It's important that people in society know something about disability life. So, inevitably, when they encounter somebody with a given condition, whether it be Turner syndrome, paralysis, or a condition they can't even see, that they're ready and willing to keep an open mind. To go into a situation saying, I don't know this person's story, but if I take the time to build a bridge of understanding, if I take the initiative to take that step to learn about another person, another type of person, maybe I'll be a little better for it. And that, my dear friends, is the beginning of wisdom. First, recognizing that other strengths, other hopes, other dreams, even other perspectives exist. Then asking the question, do I believe enough in equality to want to understand what those perspectives might be? And once I've learned this, is there anything I can do to carry this into my own life and make things better? Or to stand beside this person, whatever their struggles may be? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.